You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
This past July, Congress approved a bill that immunized the telecom industry against all pending lawsuits and vested new warrantless eavesdropping powers in the president. The Senate vote in favor of the bill was 69-28, and you might be surprised to learn that after he'd fiercely opposed the bill, Barack Obama voted for it, along with some of his fellow Democrats and every Senate Republican. Although Senator Obama called his support a close call, some of his supporters are still unclear as to why he did it. Here to explain the significance of the bill and whether we can expect the National Security Agency to change much during an Obama administration is James Bamford, the foremost expert on the subject. His third book about the NSA, The Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America, is published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him back to the show. Hi.
Hi, Leonard.
After reading your book, it's difficult not to be a little paranoid. Is there a way of knowing if someone is listening into my conversations?
Not the way NSA does it. It doesn't listen to individual phone calls. It listens to the entire stream, millions of communications as it's coming in, and then filters it through to find particular phone numbers or particular words.
So are there things that I could say that would make a computer program pick up on my private conversations?
Oh, I'm sure. If you hit the right words and the right combinations, the conversation or the email or whatever it is you're communicating with will probably be picked up by it.
I've heard that there are have been attempts by anti-NSA organizations to jam the NSA's computers by placing key phrases and on subject lines on emails.
And that may work. The way it works now is they have NSA has built filters, sort of hardwired filters into the domestic and international communications network, so that if those words that you're communicating on an email pass over a line and it goes through the NSA filter, and that filter is looking for those words, then it will be kicked out and sent to an NSA listening post to be analyzed.
Do we know what some of those words might be?
Well, they...
I mean, it's not jihad or something like that.
No, it's got to be fairly sophisticated, and they're also looking not just at the words, but where the communication is coming from, where it's going to. There's a lot of factors that they put into it. Because, you know, the problem is you're talking about millions and millions of communications, and you've got to narrow it down to a human being sitting there with earphones or reading a computer screen.
So how do we explain what was revealed in October? This is after your book, of course. There were new allegations that the NSA eavesdropped on intimate phone calls made by U.S. military personnel overseas to their loved ones back home.
Well, that was I interviewed a couple of the intercept operators, the actual people with the earphones on that were doing the eavesdropping for NSA, and they told me exactly how it worked and how they were doing it. And what was shocking to me and also shocking to them was the fact that they were eavesdropping on private communications between two Americans, Americans and their families. A lot of the times it was discussions of personal finance or sexual activity, you know, people been away from each other for a long time. So they were told to keep listening, transcribe, record it, and then the information would be stored. And that wasn't what they understood when they originally went into the NSA to be doing that.
Although they seem to enjoy it at times, Navy linguist David Murphy Falk told ABC there's good phone sex, there's some pillow talk, pull it up, it's really funny.
Exactly, and that was one of the reasons he eventually came forward and spoke to me. And then,
but why? I mean, why were they doing it? What justification would they have for listening in on private conversations that obviously don't involve spying? Are they afraid that one soldier might say to his wife, you know, we have a military installation here and it would really be vulnerable and maybe you should send a suicide bomber?
Well, this is the problem you have when you deregulate eavesdropping. You have problems when you deregulate the finance industry. This is what happens when you take the rules and regulations out of eavesdropping and somebody just says, listen to everything, and this is what happened. So both of the whistleblowers I spoke to protested at one time or another, saying they shouldn't be doing this or whatever, and they were told to just keep listening because that was the order.
And I understand the NSA is also accused of tapping into conversations that American journalists and NGO workers made home.
Well, the way it works is the eavesdropping is done various ways. In this case, it was done by a big satellite in the satellite dish in the Middle East, and it picked up everything pretty much, and then it filtered it back to NSA. And a lot of those calls were from journalists to their sources, journalists to their families, aid workers, soldiers, military people in the field. So it picked up actually most of the communications was American. Very few were Arabic, and there was almost no terrorist communications they picked up.
I'd imagine that you'd be wiretapped because it seems like anybody who's concerned about what's going on in the NSA calls James Bamford.
Well, that was one of the reasons I joined the ACLU lawsuit against NSA when I found out about the warrantless eavesdropping to see if we could put a stop to it, because NSA does have a history of eavesdropping on journalists. The first person to ever write on NSA, he wrote a chapter, David Kahn wrote a chapter in a book called The Codebreakers, and they put him on the NSA watch list, and they began targeting his communications. So NSA's had a history of doing this, and now that the rules were sort of thrown out the window, there's a good chance they could be doing it again.
My guest is James Bamford, who's written three books on the NSA, Body of Secrets, the Puzzle Palace, and now The Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America, published by Doubleday. You say that before 9/11, the NSA was downsizing. So what happened? I mean, it's obvious that there probably was a need for more real activities so that we could forestall something like that. Did the NSA have enough information, by the way, before 9/11 to have predicted what happened?
Yes. I mean, the answer to that is definitely yes. It didn't really have much to do with the downsizing. NSA had been eavesdropping on this house in Yemen that served as bin Laden's operations center for several years. And they actually picked up the very first clue to 9/11, which was a phone call in December of 1999, sending the very first hijackers, Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, from off to Kuala Lumpur, the first stop, and then the next stop was Bangkok, and from there it was to the United States and San Diego. So they had been eavesdropping on this house for years, and then they eavesdropped on the terrorists being sent to this meeting in Kuala Lumpur. And even when they were in the United States, when they were in San Diego, NSA was still eavesdropping on these hijackers. And eventually, for 2 years, they were almost 2 years, they were living in the U.S., and they eventually moved their base of operations to a town called Laurel, Maryland, which also happens to be the hometown of NSA. So you have this very odd situation, very tragic situation, the last month before the attack, that the terrorists and the NSA people were living in the same town and sharing the same supermarkets, Safeway, and exercising in Gold's Gym, the same gym. And you could almost see I've been up in the director's office on the 8th floor of Ops 2 building in NSA, and you could almost see the area where the motel is from his office.
Do you think the situation would be any better today? Because as you point out, in the old days before warrantless wiretapping, and we'll get into that whole process in a moment, the NSA was not swamped the way they are today. They only had to outsource about 100 contracts a year. Now they have to outsource 10,000 contracts a year. I want to talk about that in more detail as well. But still, with all the information that they're getting these days, could they have found that needle in a haystack if somebody was doing the equivalent of a 9/11 attack?
Well, according to a number of the people that I spoke to that were doing this work at NSA, they were saying it's more difficult now because they're bringing in far too much. That was one of the complaints that the intercept operators were saying, was that they're wasting their time listening to Americans talk pillow talk when they're not focused for every minute they're doing that. They're not spending a minute listening for terrorists, and there's just too much information out there. The real problem here is that NSA was never designed to try to find terrorists running around the world. They were designed to watch the Soviet Union and determine when and if they may launch a nuclear attack. And you're taking this agency not designed for this and trying to put a square peg in a round hole.
Well, this is typical of what happens in all military intelligence. We're always fighting the previous war. And so everything that has been designed to be aimed at the Soviet Union is now aimed at Osama bin Laden or the equivalent?
Well, it's much more difficult. During the Cold War, you had this huge country, the Soviet Union, that never went anywhere. It just sat there, and it always communicated. They were always communicating. And the best part was they were always communicating over dedicated lines.
And if you broke their codes, you pretty much understood.
And most of
saying.
It was unencrypted. They were listening to the army communicate to their field by high frequency, and it was always on the same, you know, the same basic channels, in the same way with the Navy communicating with the ships and the Air Force communicating with the planes and a lot of the diplomatic communications. Now you have the opposite. Instead of one big country sitting there and not going anywhere, you have individual terrorists that are in Kenya one day and Kuala Lumpur the next, and they're not communicating all the time. They only communicate very rarely.
And seem to be more sophisticated than the Soviet Union was. They understand that we're eavesdropping on them.
Well, exactly. They're with the Soviet Union, the U.S. had all these supercomputers that were designed to look into breaking codes. But with the terrorists, they say things like, next week is the wedding. I hope everybody shows up for it. Well, is it going to be a wedding or is it going to be a terrorist attack? You can't create computers that can do a quadrillion operations a second are great for breaking a sophisticated encryption system, but not for determining whether a wedding is a wedding or a wedding is a terrorist act.
How much has changed as a result of the change in leadership at the NSA, Michael Hayden to Keith B. Alexander?
Well, the big change was when after 9/11, when they switched over to warrantless eavesdropping, and that was under Michael Hayden, and then Keith Alexander has continued it. Keith Alexander has been probably the most secretive person in the intelligence community now. He never talks publicly. He's never given a press conference, never given an interview. So what goes on there now is very, very, very secretive. But what they're doing now is trying to develop these very high-tech ways of not only looking for information through data mining, but also trying to figure ways to have questions answered by computers rather than just look for keywords. Ask, what's Jim Bamford's next book going to be? And have the computer tell you that as opposed to just say, look for these words or whatever.
James Bamford is the best-selling author of Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and A Pretext for War. He's written on national security for all of the major publications. His latest book is The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. It is published by Doubleday. We will continue our conversation, find out how warrantless eavesdropping has worked and why it's even necessary. But first this. We're back with James Bamford, Bamford. His latest book, The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. It's published by Doubleday. You point out an interesting fact about the FISA court, that even though FISA provides a safeguard because the court has to issue a warrant, in fact, almost all requests have been granted. Out of approximately 20,000 requests, only 2 were denied. I wonder what it took to get those 2 denied.
And I think those 2 were under the Bush administration, I think. But it's not only easy to get it through the court, since there's only been 2 or 3 denied out of 20,000. But if it is denied, then there's another court called the Foreign Intelligence Court of Appeals. And that means you can go to an entirely new court and have another hearing on the eavesdropping warrant. And that court is probably very unique in terms of American legal history. It's the The court's been there for 30 years, and it's only heard one case. And if you get turned down in that case, you still have a third bite at the apple. You can go to the Supreme Court for an in-camera immediate session.
So why circumvent the FISA process when it's been little more than a rubber stamp for the NSA?
I think it was mostly arrogance. I think whatever needed to be done, it could have been done legally, either through Congress. Congress would have granted the administration whatever it wanted in the months after 9/11. If they went through Congress, which was the legal way of changing the law if they wanted it changed. And the court itself is very accommodating. If you're eavesdropping on somebody, you can continue eavesdropping on them for 3 days and in the meantime apply for a warrant. The judges are available 24 hours a day. You can go to their house at 2 in the morning and knock on their door and get a warrant. So it's a very accommodating court.
But the argument has been, well, sometimes it's an emergency. We don't have time to go through this whole process. It's been made to sound like it takes a long time to resolve something that might be an immediate problem.
Well, they've been granted 3 days, and I think in this new bill they've got 4 days or something, 4 or 5 days. So they've got plenty of time in order to have a warrant if that's what they want. The problem, I think, was more arrogance than time. They just felt that the court was an impediment to their own desire to eavesdrop when and wherever they wanted to.
How long after 9/11 did the illegal wiretaps begin?
Oh, very quickly. Almost immediately after 9/11, the NSA director, Michael Hayden, began bypassing some of the rules in terms of minimization. And then by October 4th, they had started doing the warrantless eavesdropping, so very soon afterwards.
And as you point out, because there's no regulation, the NSA is collecting too much information, choking on it, you say. So does any of this get unread, or do they just simply have to farm it all out to other people because they can't handle the volume themselves?
Well, they've expanded tremendously. They just don't have enough people themselves. So what they've done is contract out. And so you have a lot of contractors in the Washington area basically putting ads in the paper and hiring people to do eavesdropping.
And you've said some of them are foreign companies or that there's – it seems to me we're talking about something that's so top secret. At the same time, we're having all sorts of people who might leak information.
Well, one of the two major telecommunications companies, AT&T and Verizon, the hardware and software that actually does the eavesdropping is made by companies that were formed in Israel. One of the companies, Verint, the president and a couple of the other top officials were indicted for fraud and theft. And the founder of Verint is now a fugitive in Africa, and the U.S. is trying to get him back. So these are the things I think Congress should be taking a very close look at. These are the companies that build the hardware and software that do the eavesdropping on the majority of U.S. communications.
Now, why did the NSA even need to obtain the cooperation of these telecommunication giants?
Well, the way the regulation works is they require the telecommunications companies like AT&T to provide the information.
I mean, can't they just wiretap, go right to the source without asking AT&T or Verizon? They were turned down by Quest, weren't they?
That's right. But AT&T, for example, did agree to go along. And what the problem is this. It's technological. Prior to in the late 90s, the way they did most of the eavesdropping was with big dishes, picking up satellite communications. After the late 90s and into the 2000s, a great deal of the communications was not going by satellite anymore. It was going by undersea cable. And the only way you can get traffic in a cable is by tapping into it. So that's when NSA began building these secret rooms inside buildings like AT&T. And then they began putting the room inside the room. They began putting in this hardware and software. So what you have is the entire telecommunications system, both domestic and international, passing through these NSA filters looking for communications.
And would we even know about this if that whistleblower at AT&T hadn't talked about a room that he had seen?
No, Mark Klein, I think, is a hero because he pointed out the fact that these rooms were in existence, and I think people should know. If the government is eavesdropping on your communications, if they're reading your mail as it goes into the post office, if they're doing any of those kind of things, I think it's the public should know about it. And that was the first word that came out was when Mark Klein, who had been there for 22 years with AT&T, saw this secret room being built that only NSA people had access to. And then he found out there were a dozen or more of these elsewhere around the country.
And Verizon has its own.
Verizon has their facility down in Texas. Verizon's a bit more careful, I think, than AT&T in terms of having the information pass through. But all this is sort of very secret from the American public, how their communications are being listened to and eavesdropped on.
And one of the most remarkable things you've turned up in this book is how poorly information is actually being used by the NSA, simply because, as we've said earlier, there's just so much information to be sifted through?
Well, so much, and then they do this data mining where they take one number and then they look at what numbers have called that number and what numbers have called the numbers that they were looking at beyond the tree. They create this telephone tree with all these branches of who calls who. And the further you go out, the less likely that there's anybody that's involved in any kind of terrorism or anything. I mean, you're getting out to the babysitters and the pizza delivery people and so forth. So that was what was really getting a lot of the people in the FBI angry, because instead of being able to go out and follow leads, they were being flooded with all this information that was virtually useless.
My guest is James Bamford. His latest book, The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America, published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, AM, FM, and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You have interviewed a couple of operators who became whistleblowers. Between the two operators, they worked as interceptors from 2001 to 2007. What made them come forward, and why? I assume they came to you because you'd written other books.
Well, they had come to me basically for two different reasons. One of them was Adrian Kinney, who was an intercept operator, had been there 4 years before 9/11 and knew exactly how it should work, and that before 9/11, if they came across an American, they would not record the conversations. They would turn them off.
Because that was considered illegal?
Because it was illegal at the time.
And we're not allowed to spy domestically.
Well, that and it was a waste of time, basically, listening to Americans, and they needed a warrant to do that. So after 9/11, all of a sudden they began eavesdropping on all these Americans, and she got very angry that they were doing this, and she thought it was a waste of time. These are educated people. Both of them have master's degrees, and one had a master's in German from University of Chicago. The other person, Murphy Falk, that I interviewed, was angry because they were not only intercepting these conversations, but then they were turning them into jokes within the listening spaces. Say, hey, come on over and listen to this conversation between, you know, a soldier in Iraq and his wife or family back in the U.S. So he got very angry about that and wanted it changed. Adrian Kinney tried very hard to have the system corrected within the working within the system. She complained to her commanding officer. That didn't do any good. Then when she got out of the military, and she got out of the military with an honorable discharge and so forth, had high marks in the military. She sent a letter explaining all this to Senator Leahy in Vermont, who was on the Judiciary Committee and the Intelligence Committee, and didn't hear anything back for a year and a half, never heard anything back in the year and a half. And that's one of the reasons she decided to go forward.
So, why do you think he didn't respond? And why do you think that Barack Obama didn't stand by his original commitment to support a filibuster against passage of the recent bill.
Well, what Senator Leahy said was that he forwarded it to the Pentagon, and the Pentagon sent it to the NSA Inspector General, and they looked at it and said there was nothing to it. What's very interesting is none of them ever bothered to call back the original person who made the complaint. And I, having been a journalist for a very long time, I can't imagine looking into a complaint and never at any time before I finished the investigation talk to the person who made the complaint.
Well, this is like you saying to somebody, Leonard Lopate stole my wallet, and then sending it to my relatives and asking them if it's possible that I did such a thing.
Right, without ever asking or doing any initial investigation of what really happened in the first place. And that's the problem. And that's why I think that...
Well, the whistleblowers, are they okay or have... Because in some countries, they might very well have been brought up on spying charges or
treason.
Well,
that may happen here, too. It's hard to say because this is so unusual. Both Senator Rockefeller, who's chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and Senator Leahy, who's now chairman of the Judiciary Committee, have both now said that they are going to conduct a real investigation, so we'll have to see.
Hadn't you thought that the NSA had cut back on some of its operations until you started hearing from these whistleblowers?
Well, I they had cut back on a lot of the operations during the 1990s. They cut back by a third, and then they expanded extremely fast rate after 2001. But what surprised me about the whistleblowers was how blatant the eavesdropping was on U.S. citizens, how there was no use of common sense that if you're listening to, a soldier or a journalist talk to his or her spouse, that it's not going to be productive from an intelligence viewpoint.
The NSA is intercepting all of these huge amounts of communications, and then it all goes into a big funnel at Fort George, Georgia, near Augusta. Haven't you toured that facility?
Well, I've toured the NSA headquarters, which is at Fort George Meade in Maryland. That's a huge – they actually have a huge city, about 50 buildings, and I've been through that a number of times. I'm one of the few outsiders that they've ever permitted in.
And why did they let you in? I would think you'd be the last one that they would let in.
Well, they let me in the first time because I was part of a sort of a out-of-court settlement. They were it's a long story, but when I wrote The Puzzle Palace, my first book, I got them to give me a tour of the place and interviews. And then when my sequel came out, Body of Secrets, they also gave me a tour. The first book, they threatened me with prosecution. The second book, they had a book signing for me at NSA. So it's sort of a love-hate relationship with the agency. I've been doing it for so long. But the place where the actual intercept operators were working was down at Fort Gordon in Georgia, the U.S. state of Georgia, just south of the South Carolina border. And that's actually the largest listening post in the world now. They're expanding it. We'll soon have about 4,000 people down there. And that's where they do all the eavesdropping on the Middle East.
But you point out that despite employing so many people, they actually don't have any employees who speak Pashtun and probably not enough to speak other languages that are used in the Middle East and other places where we would probably want to know what's going on.
Well, that was another thing that astonished me when I actually interviewed the intercept operators down there was the fact that even though we went to war in Afghanistan and we're constantly fighting the Taliban, they had nobody down there that spoke the language of the Taliban, which was Pashtun. They made one sort of half-hearted attempt to get some Arabic speaker, Arabic linguist down there to cross-train into Pashtun, but it didn't work very well. So you have this enormous agency out there, and people think it's doing these amazing things, eavesdropping on all these communications in the part of the world that we're having wars with, and it's really astonishing how little they're actually getting from that area.
And that's true even today? I mean, it's 7 years since 9/11. I would have thought that they could have found one or two Pashtun speakers if they're going to engage in this kind of activity. I mean, you're collecting all this data, and then you can't even find out what people are saying.
Well, NSA won't hire people from the indigenous area, so they have to use regular old Americans and train them in a school on how to speak Pashtun, and it's very difficult, and they haven't had a lot of success.
And they wouldn't trust Afghans who are American citizens, or any number of them.
They wouldn't even trust the instructor that went down there to teach some of these people. They told them they couldn't even tell the instructor what they were teaching these people to learn. So the instructor ended up teaching them, you know, the word for fork and things like that, conversational Pashtun, when what they were supposed to be learning was words for bomb and so forth, but they didn't want to tell the instructor, who didn't have a clearance because it was a native speaker, why these people were learning, had to learn Pashtun.
Jim, this is so scary. I mean, when you get all this information, do you think, oh my God, why aren't more people talking about this? Why isn't this a daily story in the New York Times and other major publications?
Well, I've long ago sort of learned that that'll just never happen because, you know, look at the CIA. There's probably hundreds of books written on the CIA. There's only been 3 books ever written on NSA, and I wrote all 3. So getting information from NSA is an extremely difficult task. I've just been doing it since 1982, so I've found a sort of a knack to doing it. And but that's the problem. It's a problem of getting people to focus on this agency that has so much power, in a sense. It's 3 times the size of the CIA, for example.
And I'd assume that most people who are working for the NSA believe in the mission and really don't want to undermine it by talking to someone like you.
Well, I believe in the mission. Again, in my last book, they had a book signing for me at NSA. I mean, I do believe in NSA. I defended NSA a number of times, even before the European Parliament in Brussels at one point. What set me off this time was the fact that as I'm defending NSA and saying they're not breaking the law, lo and behold, I find out they are breaking the law. So that's why I decided to write a third book on NSA to sort of look at that whole post from 9/11 on period.
Do you think you'll be able to take a vacation from the NSA anytime soon?
Well, I hope so. You spend years and years on these books, and then you would like to hear, you know, go one whole day without hearing the initials NSA. So, yes.
Well, I'm sorry I didn't spare you that today, but thank you so much for coming on our show. James Bamford, BAMFORD, his latest book, sure to follow his other 2 bestsellers on the NSA, this one called The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. It's published by Doubleday.
Thanks, Leonard.